I'm like, okay, now I've got a dilemma as an official. Do you wait or do you tell him? I'm like, well, Friday in a cut, I haven't got a chance to wait. You know, you're an official. If you interject yourself into their world, then, you know, beware.
Welcome back to another Park Train. I'm one of your co-hosts, Evan Singer. We got Mr. Matt Cermak here. His mic is broken, so he's literally holding it like he's on stage. What's going on, my man?
It's good to see you. Park Train's rocking and rolling.
Excited about this episode. You guys are going to love it. In case you're new, when you're on the Par Train, guys, I'm sure you've been on it, even for two holes. You made two pars in a row. You're feeling good. Golf, the hardest game in the world, feels easy, right? Our mission is to understand why, so we can apply these lessons of riding the train on and off the course, make the hard stuff seem easy, and help you get better. With interviews from PGA Tour pros, best-selling authors, CEOs, mental coaches, and rules officials / senior tournament directors like Stephen Cox today, you will get the motivation to keep chugging and finally learn how to enjoy the ride. Is that fun?
That is actually very fun.
It's fun.
We learned a lot today. But before we get into our great episode, we got to hear from our friends, Ev.
Tell us about the latest signing that Roback Apparel made on tour.
So for all that you don't know, Roback is partnered with Wesley Bryant, PGA Tour player, great player, which is pretty cool. You and I are wearing their stuff every day, but you know they're growing fast. And pretty cool to see them get the first PGA Tour player, Wesley Bryant. So guys, more proof in the pudding. This stuff isn't just for your average 15 handicapper. It's for the best players in the world. Stuff's great.
Yeah, and the founders are amazing. They're really great people. You feel good when you buy stuff from them. I want to read these. We're going to start reading some reviews to give you guys a little extra context. This person named John from Louisiana said, Roback is my new favorite company. I love the feel of their polos. I wear them all of the time. I started with two and now I've bought 12. Sounds like us. For golf, going out to friends' houses, or just hanging in the backyard, you can find me wearing one of their polos. That's just polos, right?
Yeah.
So, guys, hit the link in our show notes. The link is always in our social accounts, too, at the Par Train, always linked in our bio. You click on that link, you get yourself 15% off your first Roback shirt. If you've already bought Roback stuff from us, keep buying it using that link. It helps us continue working with Roback. It shows that you guys are listening. It shows that you guys are enjoying it. But the discount is for first-time buyers only. Keep that in mind. And new stuff is coming out, I think, in a week or so. Some new styles and some things are getting restocked. So keep checking back, roback.com. Check the link in our bio. Make sure you click from there. No promo code needed.
You've got to click that link.
Okay. Stephen Cox, rules official on the PGA Tour, senior tournament director. Big shout out to Mike Winehouse for hooking this up and introducing us to Stephen. I really loved this episode. I think this is a little bit different than anything we've ever done, Matt. We debated rule changes. We debated red versus white stakes. We heard some amazing stories about him getting chewed out by Jordan Spieth and working with Bryson and even course setups, why they need to go to a course 2 years before a tour event and how they decide to set it up for an event. A lot of interesting stuff I didn't know.
What tour players or what amateurs, you know, how can you use the rules to your advantage? What to look out for in terms of future, you know, rule changes, you know, coming down the pipeline. And, you know, and he even got the pace of play talk. That was really, really interesting.
Yeah, definitely stay to the end. Pace of play is towards the end. If you guys aren't currently following us, again, at the Par Train, give us a follow on all the platforms socially. And guys, I hope that these episodes, we don't say this often, but you know, we genuinely do this podcast to help you with your game. And so all these messages and DMs and tweets we're getting about how, you know, our mental game episodes have helped you with your game, or this instructor has kind of made you think about your swing differently. That's why we do it. And so all we ask in return is to subscribe and give us a review. Pretty easy win-win relationship we have here, right?
So DM us.
If you're enjoying this, make sure you're subscribed. It helps us move up the ranks so we can keep doing this for you. And we love doing it. So Hope you guys stay well, keep chugging, and enjoy the ride out there. First, I want to start you off with a little football, Steven. I hear you're a Jaguars fan, and Urban Meyer is coming to Jacksonville. What are your thoughts, and how many wins do you think Urban can produce for the Jags?
I thought you were going to start with a football question in my native tongue and land. I thought, wow, he's going to start off with an English football question. That's cool.
Real football, right?
I'd like to talk about my Premier League team and how I'm doing in the league right now.
We can talk about that, too.
The whole Jags question. Hey, look, firstly, I'm excited. I've learned a lot since I've come over here about American football, American sports. You know, when I was a kid growing up, we had one game a week, and that was the Sunday night game at, I think it's like 8 o'clock or 8:30. So you'd tune in at 5 hours in the UK, and, you know, I always had a Monday morning lecture at 9 o'clock at university, and I'd walk in there, and the tutor, I think it was like corporate marketing or something like that, and I'd be half asleep during the lecture, and he had no idea that we spent half the night watching American football. That was it. If you didn't, of course, your facilities as a student back when I was a student, you didn't have the ability to record the game or anything. So it was one game a week. And let's just say I've learned an awful lot about American football since I've come over here. I've had to learn very quickly about that, particularly the college sports side of it as well. But we are super excited about everything that is Jaguars football. It's been a rough ride since we had that run probably three years ago, whenever it was. With a potentially a new quarterback coming into town and Urban coming to town, it's just the lift that the team needed. We've got some room in the salary cap, and we've got some really exciting opportunities with other draft picks. So let's hope we can be smart and choose carefully, and some of these picks that, you know, really start to pay off down the line. But the energy and excitement in the city is there to be seen after those recent announcements, for sure.
Yeah, it's funny, Steven. I was telling Matt off air before the show, you know, I grew up in St. Louis, and we didn't have a team when I was younger. The Rams came later, but when the Jags started, my first NFL hat was actually the Jaguars, because, you know, it was kind of this cool, like, teal and gold logo, and it was a brand new team. And it's like, all right, I guess I'm going to join the Jags. So I actually have pictures of me as a kid wearing a Jaguars hat, which is funny.
Once a Jags fan, always a Jags fan.
Yeah. So are you going to make a prediction, or are you passing on the win total?
Oh, that would be tough. I would like to think that we can sort of break even. You know, yeah. I mean, I know it doesn't sound very a lofty goal, but we've had some rough seasons coming out of a one win season. I think if we can get to 8-8 in our first year and then build upon that, similar to like the Browns have done. I mean, obviously, I'd like a little bit of a quick transition, but we can maybe get to 8-8 in our first year and then build upon that. I think that would be a good start.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's definitely possible. Better times coming in Jacksonville. Steven, so thanks for coming on the show. We posed a couple questions to our followers about maybe what they'd like us to ask you. In this famous rules question of why still can we not get a drop out of a sand-filled divot, we've seen a lot of rule changes lately, and we're going to talk about some of those. But help us understand that one and give us, our listeners, some context.
So I think there's I get asked this question an awful lot, and there's two, and you can argue it, and this is something that we're probably going to be arguing until the rules get changed, but it's the nature of an outside sport that, you know, just because you hit it in the fairway, that doesn't always guarantee you a good lie. And I know it is incredibly frustrating that you, when you hit it in the fairway, you find a divot, but that unfortunately is the nature of our sport. In a similar vein that, you know, I know this is a frustration certainly in the modern day game, that if you hit the ball in the fairway and you've got, you know, mud or other items attached to your ball that you can't clean, which obviously then has an opportunity to affect the flight of the ball. And then from a pure rules mechanics standpoint, and I think this is where I have a bit of a hang up with it, is that at what point does a divot cease to be a divot? You know, the changes in 19 that kicked in, and you only have to look at them, there are so few penalties that are being applied now within certainly in the elite level game, that, you know, it's very much cleaned up a lot of these gray areas. And for us, there's so many irregularity of surfaces in fairways that, you know, I suspect that if we started relieving from divots, then at some point there's going to be a crossover between what was a divot and what is now not a divot. And I suspect that any sort of depression, thin area of ground could very easily be argued. I certainly, as a player, would argue that, hey, this is a divot. You can clearly see that's a divot as opposed to a divot that has sufficiently recovered not to warrant relief. So, you know, it just opens up a bit of a can of worms. But that's my sort of general take on it.
To your point, there could be just a tad of sand in a divot, right? And then as a player, you can go make that argument, right? It just opens up a whole new conversation.
Yeah. And I think I mean, obviously divots are so prevalent as well. And, but I fully understand that it is frustrating. It's a frustrating thing when you hit a great shot and you don't get rewarded for it.
So Stephen, you mentioned you get asked that question a lot. I was just curious, as a rules official, senior tournament director, how often do your friends text you golf rules questions? Is it like a weekly thing where you're the source of truth?
Do you know the person who texts me the most is my wife, believe it or not. And she's a golfer. But my middle daughter, I've got three daughters, and my middle daughter is really keen. And she plays in, there's a great little tour, North Florida Junior Golf Tour. And when I was growing up, we had a nice little, you know, it was back in the day, it was the counties in England, and that's how you played your golf. And they had a good little junior organization, but there was no tour as such. The parents, as you'd expect, can't get involved, but she sees things going on and she'll be texting me saying, hey, what? I'm like, sweetheart, I'm trying to conduct the BMW championship or whatever here. And you know, you're answering a query from your wife at the same time about what's going on in your junior golf. So she's probably the worst, but I'll occasionally get, you know, either friends back home who are trying to settle a debate, they've played out, they've had 18 holes of golf, something's gone on, and then all of a sudden one of your mates, after about three or four beers, will say, oh, hey, look, I'm going to shoot the guy who's going to be the definitive answer on this one. Generally speaking, if they don't respond, that means they've got it wrong. If they respond quickly, that means they were right in the argument. So
that's interesting, Stephen, and you brought up your daughter playing in junior golf. So I grew up playing competitively since I was very little, and we all carried USGA rule books in our bags as junior players. I think obviously the idea behind those little pocketbooks, the idea behind that was, well, for junior, younger kids to learn the rules, but, and also to figure out the rules, you know, of a situation. But it seemed like, and I thought it was very helpful looking back, and that whole idea of carrying around your book kind of phased out. We don't see it anymore. And I guess, does it even still exist? And
the player's edition, which is a scaled down version of what we would carry out on tour, or if you went down to the, you know, if you got your documentary stuff from the full rules or from the USGA or RNA, but there is a slightly scale, and it's a nice little pocket edition, which can even be on your back pocket, or, you know, more often it'll just sit in your golf bag. But still, it's quite comprehensive still. So it is, certainly for a kid, it's very daunting to look at that. And I mean, they've got no idea where to look or where to start.
Right.
And, you know, as much as the new code is put into different language to make it easier, as a moving away from, you know, hate to say it, but lawyer words and talk and try to put it into layman's terms to use words which are a little bit easier to understand. But, you know, for a kid of 13 and 14, you know, it is unfortunately, just like you and I learn the rules, you're learning it from the people you're playing with. You're learning by mistakes, unfortunately.
Right.
And as much as, you know, you'll try and work with kids in different environments, it's a trickle effect. There's only so much that can be taken in at any one point.
So, Stephen, what's the most common rule most people get wrong? And that could be amateurs or pros. It's up to you.
Oh, goodness me. I mean, it's really difficult to get things wrong now under the new code. I think probably identification of a golf ball. Again, we modified that in 19, you know, back in the old days, it used to be, you used to mark, you can't, you know, you wouldn't permit it to clean, or you can clean to the extent necessary, but and you also need to inform your, you know, your opponent, your fellow competitor that you were doing so. Well, we sort of modified that a little bit to say, look, you know, we don't really need you to, although it's good etiquette and best practice to inform your playing partner that you're going to lift it, but the rules still require you to mark it. I think casual water is another one which is so often abused as well. You know, people start stamping around and pressing their foot on the ground and, hey, I got water coming up here. Well, that's just, again, that's not the mechanics of the way that rule works.
That's a great point.
So, you know, you see it. I mean, we have that argument at tour level as well. You know, guys say, casual water here. Well, let's just go take your stance. Is it visible before? No. Well, let's go take your stance and let's get settled. And is it visible? No. All right. You're playing away.
Right.
And we have slightly different standards for, you know, where the ball is sitting and where the player is standing as well, which is, gets a little bit more confusing. But so often a little bit of water will be coming up when they press their foot down, and then it's right. Okay. I'm going to take relief and get it to a nicer spot.
Yeah.
So, but I think the identification certainly across the board in, you know, all levels, not necessarily, it doesn't really happen in elite level golf, but certainly across social golf, people just pick it up.
Yeah.
Some rules are more important than others.
What about a rule that amateurs can take advantage of the most as currently written?
The most important change for me, or a couple of changes, was I never understood the principles behind penalizing a player for moving his ball while searching for it. Never understood the dynamics behind that. You know, there's you. You're looking for your ball. Who's most interested in looking for your ball? It's you, right? The player. Mm-hmm. You'd be looking for your ball, and then in a long rough or in a bush or whatever, and then, who got penalized for moving that ball? The player while he was searching for it. So what inevitably happened on the old rules is the player would sort of cease and back off and be, you know, really, really careful, and it sort of defeated the object. And we had so many incredibly unfair situations where players were penalized for, particularly in the long rough, standing on their golf ball. I'll tell you a story about that in a minute, but it sort of never really made sense. Now, of course, under new rules, if a player is searching for it and, you know, he causes that ball to move, you know, in search, you know, just no worries, put it back, no problem, and just, you know, proceed onward. I can remember we were at Plainfield, I think it was, back in the Barclays days. And I can't remember, it's a par five, which goes out to the far end of the course. And this was pre the changes. And Jordan Spieth had hit it into this, I think he'd gone for the green too, and it's like a ditch and it penalty area. And it was very heavily grassed, you know, long fescue grasses. And he was searching for it. You know, he was one of those sort of ones where you might get lucky and you could just play it out of there. And I wasn't there, but Mark Carnevell was following that group for PGA Tour Radio. And Jordan stepped on his ball while searching for it, and, you know, in long rough. And then because of the line, everything proceeded under the water hazard rule, didn't play it. So I'm on the next hole, and Carney comes over and he says, hey, Coxie, if you stand on your golf ball, is that like, what's the deal with that? I said, talk me through the dynamics and, you know, how it all played out. And I said, well, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, in this, you know, in that situation, he's likely to have moved the ball downwards, caused the ball to move, and he would incur the penalty of one stroke and then have to replace it. And then if you subsequently wish to take relief from the penalty area, then, you know, he would do that for an additional penalty. Well, I said, well, I've just looked at his scorecard. Jordan, I don't think he knows that. He just proceeded to take relief, you know, under penalty. So I'm like, okay, this is Friday. And he's like two out of the cut, trying to make the cut, two out of the cut. So I'm like, okay, now I've got a dilemma as an official. Do you wait or do you tell him? I'm like, well, Friday in a cut, I haven't got a chance to wait. So I start walking down the fairway with Michael, and anytime that we peel inside the ropes is usually it's like, okay, what do you want? You know, unless they're out of position and they know it's coming. But so I said, hey, just you walk me through what happened the last hole, you know, blah, blah, blah. I was looking for ball, stood on it, and then I couldn't play it. So, and I said, anyway, I just said, look, you're not going to like the sound of this, but it looks like you stood on the ball and you've caused it to move. And on that basis, you're going to get a penalty stroke. And then you're going to obviously incur your other penalty, which you have added to your score for proceeding under the penalty area rule. But I said, but we can talk more about this when you come into the scoring area. And he snapped back at me and he said, yeah, that's exactly where we should have handled it. Which, you know, it's not uncommon that, you know, you enter a player's domain. It may be a very passive sport, but don't believe me, these guys are incredibly focused in what they're doing. And I think that's very missed. You know, you know, these physical sports, you see it there firsthand when you golf. These guys are incredibly focused in what they're doing. You know, you as an official, if you interject yourself into their world, then, you know, beware. So I said, hey, I get it, totally get it. You know, and then obviously he was very frustrated, missed the cut. And it was only afterwards that we sat down and I said, hey, you understand why I had no choice but to come in and address this situation? And she said, can you imagine the situation, the fallout, if you'd have birdied two coming in, made the cut on the number, and I walked into scoring and said, hey, by the way, yeah, we're going to tag another one on and you're going to miss the cut by one. The first question he's going to ask is, why didn't you tell me that? Why wouldn't you tell me?
You can't win.
You can't win. And it's one of those really, really awkward situations that you don't want to have to do. But that's where, you know, sometimes you've got to be street smart. Sometimes we'll go in there and inform the player. And I'm sure you've heard the likes of Slugger White say it before. You know, John Rahm, I think, at Muirfield. You know, he chose not to say anything until he'd come in. I didn't have that privilege at that particular situation with Jordan. I had to tell him because he was grinding to make the cut. That's just the way it is.
Yeah. Well, that's a similar scenario to what happened with DJ. It was at Oakmont, I believe, right? Where the ball moved and he was coming in to win his first major. And I believe he wasn't told. No, they went out and told him, right? But that was a big thing as well of whether
we had the whole, again, you talk about changes for us and my world. And speeds of greens and balling and all that. I mean, that was certainly for us on tour as officials, it was the worst case scenario for us. I mean, the whole Dustin situation was, well, we've ruled this way. It was Mark Newell, who was the chairman of the rules committee at the time. He'd ruled no penalty at the time, and then subsequently it was reviewed on TV, and we're like, oh, I think the guys there were like, oh, hold on, we might want to take another look at this. So, and then I think they alerted him that there may be a penalty, but they wanted Dustin to be able to see it when it came in. Well, now we're into this dilemma, and we've left the player hanging, and you know that they had no choice but to tell him because they didn't know how it was going to play out down the stretch. But you know, it's never a great thing to leave the players hanging with some degree of uncertainty. I mean, that's in an ideal world. You know, golf allows us to take our time. We can continue playing and review a situation and then retrospectively come back and actually either take the penalty away or, for that matter, just add it on if after the consultation. But to leave it as hanging as long as that was not ideal, and I think we all within the game recognized that. But in terms of a rules change, that was just such a huge move for us because we were getting so many green speeds were so quick and you know, quite close to the line, and you know, players were doing nothing, really nothing, particularly when you get out on the West Coast and you're operating with par and your greens and you know, any sort of little, you know, it's just little, you know, irregularity of surface, you just can call the ball, you know, cause the ball to move. The player really he doesn't need to do anything,
right?
But he was getting handcuffed and tagged with penalty strokes unnecessarily, and it was just so unfair. And so when we introduced the rule of, you know, an accidental movement of the putting green was no penalty, that was a big change for us. Again, when the greens are slower and they're not moving so much, then it wasn't so much of a big issue. But still, you know, if you're foolish and you accidentally just step backwards and you step on your golf ball, an amateur golf, you know, hey, no worries. you're on the putting green, just go ahead and replace it. No penalty if it was accidental. So that was a, I mean, for us on tour, that was a big change. Jordan and I didn't get off to a great start. He's a lovely guy. I love him to bits.
Stephen, as you talk about good changes versus bad changes, also curious to get your thoughts on the influence of replay and digital media. I think we've seen a lot in the last several years where people are calling in, people are tweeting in. We've seen this, you know, exposed what many thought was cheating, you know, from Patrick Reed. We saw, you know, which was potentially an illegal drop with Tiger at the Masters a few years ago. And then there's the, people talk in the sense that, you know, we're just, everybody can be a court armchair quarterback and send in, and we're kind of losing any integrity or naturalness of the rules. And I wanted to, so wanted to get your take on how the discussions you and your colleagues have around all this.
Well, let me start by saying that the game has never been more, you know, broadcasted than it is right now. You know, with the evolution of PGA Tour Live and all of these other platforms for you, for someone at home to watch golf, there's never a greater opportunity for someone to see live golf than it is today. And I suspect that's only going to continue. So there's that dilemma. You know, before, you know, 20 years ago when you and I were, you know, watching golf, you know, it was just a little short network window, 2-3 hours maybe. And outside of that, you're on your own. That's an issue that we face. And then I think probably maybe a couple of years ago, I think it was, you know, within the game, we were all genuinely concerned in the direction this was going. So we all got together and said, look, this can't continue. We can't, we've only got probably 8 or 9 officials on course. We can't have our eyes and ears everywhere. And it's not right that people are calling in about this, that, and the other. And unfortunately, 90% of the stuff, 95% of the stuff that was being called in about was, you know, was nothing. So we were spending a lot of our time just following up, useless.
Using these calls, right?
You know, yeah. Reviewing this, reviewing that. And he was like, this is, we're going down the wrong road here. So we put out to the golfing world, look, we're not taking reviews anymore. But what we will do to combat this is we'll do a couple of things. Firstly, we're not going to hold a player to an unusual fair standard. So we brought in, it's almost like we call it a naked eye test. So if the guy's proceeding with good and reasonable judgment, if he doesn't quite get the ball when replacing, back in exactly the same spot, because the reality is he's not getting it back in the same spot. You can try all you like, but mathematically you're not getting it back in the same spot. It's not on the same dimple. But what is reasonable? As a, you know, and obviously with high definition cameras and everything like that, there was, you know, the broadcasters, you know, love these close in shots, and you know, the guy would, you know, pick it up, put the marker in position A, and then when he put his ball back, it wasn't quite there. And we were, you know, we were in a very, very difficult position once, you know, when we started reviewing this stuff. And so we're like, okay, we need to change the dynamics of the rule to recognize the evolution of video technology. So, and a specialist in their field who's looking for things like this. So you don't need a call in. So that has put all that to bed, yeah, thankfully, because it was, we were going down the wrong road. And, you know, certainly our higher profile flagship players who featured very prominently on the broadcast window felt that they were being held to an unfair standard over, you know, some guys who weren't quite getting as much attention. So I think, and that has really settled down both of those two elements.
Everybody thinks they're an expert, right? Calling in, and it's usually much more, it's not as simple as that. But
I've got to be honest, I miss the days of ringing, because they're ringing up to, hey, it's such and such from such and, you know, such, right, a place, and I've just spotted a violation, and right, you guys probably won't do anything about it anyway, but I just want to let you know, it's, right. I love ringing them back up and saying, hey, Mike, who's this? It's Stephen Cox from the PGA Tour Rules Committee. I'm just calling you back. I just want to get a little bit more. And they're like, is it really you? Like, Yeah, of course. I hear you've been watching. Thanks for tuning in to the Players' Championship. But can you sort of just walk us through, you know, this violation that you spotted? I mean, we're all interested to hear. You've got the whole committee here on speakerphone, and And I'm like, I didn't think you'd call me back. All right, we want to hear what you have to say.
Steven,
you
know, I wonder what would have happened if people could have still called in this past season. The cameras are so good. Do you think the fans would have been able to see the fire ants under Bryson's feet to be able to call? Do you think they would have called that in?
I don't think so. Oh, dear. Bryson, he's I don't know how much time you spent with him. I really enjoy his company. I really do. But, you know, they're very focused on what they're doing. And he's no different to a lot of guys out there when they get in the heat of the moment. But, yeah, Ken Tackett, who had that ruling, and he's we often laugh about that particular situation for sure.
All right, hang tight, guys. We're going to do a quick word from our sponsor, and then we'll be right back to the interview. Imagine Golf. Have you guys heard of this new app? It is unbelievable, guys. You guys are into the mental game. We're into the mental game. Imagine Golf is all about the mental game. Okay, they have over 100,000 students, a 4.9 star rating, thousands of reviews, and the app can be totally custom to you. It's super cool. So when you first open the app, they got a bunch of different sections to make it personal to you. So you can click on pro tips, consistency, visualizations, shot strategies, range drills, stories, etc. We're even talking to them about maybe doing our own teaching series in the future from all the lessons we've learned on the train. But anyways, guys, go to imaginegolf.com/thepartrain to download the app. Make sure you use this special link, because that's the way that they're tracking who downloads the app in from listening to this show in the month of January. And guess what? They're going to pick one person to get a brand new Scotty Cameron putter of your choice, any Scotty Cameron up to $400, which is really most of them. But it's really a no-brainer. You're going to help your mental game. There's a 7-day free trial, so don't worry if you're not ready to pay monthly yet. It's a small payment per month, but there's a 7-day trial. Get the app at imaginegolf.com/thepartrain and improve your game on and off the course with the best mental game tips from anywhere around. And you might win a new Scotty Cameron putter. Sounds like a win-win to me. Hope you guys are enjoying it out there. Enjoy the ride. And let's get back to the interview.
This is a simple one, but we think for some of our listeners, it's important. And can you talk about the thought process? And this may go back a bit, red stakes versus yellow stakes. And we think this is an area where especially people don't always get right on the golf course, especially yellow. But, you know, Evan might want to talk about white stakes too. And he thinks he gets too penalized if he hits it, you know, not a crazy far offline, but he's got a re-tee. So why wanted for you to give some context really on stakes and the colors.
you've got usually, generally speaking, bodies of water, all right, that are marked either yellow or red.
Yep.
And the nuts and bolts of it is if it's red, you have additional option available that you don't have when it's yellow, and that's two club lengths from where it last crossed the margin of the penalty area. So in situations where I always use the so if you've got a penalty area which is, let's say it's the 18th at Pebble Beach, you've got the ocean to the left, which is a red penalty area, there's only one way to go. You've got to come to the right. Okay, so we're going to offer, and it's very difficult to come behind it because it's running lateral to the hole. So we're going to, that player hooks it in. We're going to offer him not only back in line, keeping the point of the flag where it last crossed back in line, which is your fundamental option when it's yellow. We're also going to allow that player to come out to the side to measure two club lengths, because he can't go left. Very difficult to go left anyway. But going right will allow him to come out.
Right.
Now, there are certain holes where, in my opinion, it wouldn't be the best interest to mark it red. You want to keep it yellow because you want to protect the integrity of the golf hole. 17th is TPC Sawgrass. So one of the challenges that Pete, when he designed that, was he asked the question of the player that he wanted to navigate that water and stay on the water. That was the challenge. And if you didn't quite manage it the first time, then we'll allow you to move up probably 60, 70 yards and proceed to the ball drop. But, you know, that's the challenge. That's what the architect is asking of you. And as much as some people might think that if you fly the green and trickles over the back edge, that you should be able to drop it within two club lengths because it's marked red. You've not, certainly for elite level golf, you've not satisfied the requirement. There is the integrity of that golf hole provides that you navigate over water and landed on that island green. So, you know, and if you don't, then you can either re-tee where you played your last stroke from, or you can go back as far as you want, keeping that point in line, or in that situation, you can, you know, you go to the ball drop. But, you know, yellow, more often than not, yellow is getting used less and less because the game wants to provide options for players. It wants to be easier. And if you're crossing over something, and like the 15th hole at the Masters tournament, or Augusta National, you know, generally speaking, wherever you go in there, you can always come fairway side and play it. It's a big, nice, wide fairway. It's not impractical for the player to do so. It doesn't need to be marked red. So if you spin it back off the green, just go back in line. Right. Generally speaking, if you've got bodies of water which run down the side of a hole, then you're going to offer it a different option for that player. But, you know, like you say, I think most golf courses now are leaning to marking more things red than they are yellow. Hopefully that was a satisfactory explanation. I got a little bit long-winded on you, but it's nice to have context.
It's very good. Very good context.
Yeah, let's talk about white for a second, Stephen, because I think this is probably, I think the red and yellow among amateurs creates probably the most confusion, right? A lot of beginner golfers, they have no idea the difference, and they usually have to ask the more avid golfer in the group if they have one. But white is interesting because I think it's the most penalizing for amateur golfers, and teeing three off the tee all day is no way to score, and it drives up your score real quick. And I think a lot of amateurs on the flip side will say, oh, well, I don't know. You know, they probably hit less provisionals, and it's more about, all right, well, we'll just drop up there. So it's the question of why, because I know, I feel like I've heard this debate a lot recently, whether it's been officially or just amongst, you know, my peers and people like me. But it almost seems like people want to just have red stakes everywhere, and you take where it went out, you take your distance, you speed up, you're hitting three from the rough versus from the tee, and you play that way. Maybe talk about that and what the consequences would be if we took out white stakes. What would happen?
Well, I think, yeah, you're right. I mean, the penalties for, it's not just a one-stroke penalty, is it? It's, I mean, you're getting penalized twice because you're hitting it again, and you're also getting the additional penalty. So, that is the penalty for, you know, one of the fundamentals is, look, we want you to keep that ball on the golf course per se. And if you don't, then you're gonna unfortunately be sort of for it. But I think on a lot of courses nowadays, two things are happening. Firstly, with the rules changes to allow people to keep scoring, because I mean, if you and I are out there playing and you hit a decent tee shot and it's up there down the left hand side, and you don't realize there's a boundary up there, and you get up there and you think, damn, I've now got to walk back 250, 300 yards back to the tee. You know, the reality is you're just going to drop one right there,
right?
And that's what's happening. And I think the game understood that. So, but it didn't really have any mechanism to provide a score, particularly with the new handicapping, you know, requirements that have just been brought in, people posting scores and everything like that. So they're now brought in a local rule, which most clubs have implemented, whereby it still allows that player to legitimately put a score together. He's still going to get penalized for dropping right there, but within the rule book, if you look in the model local rules under the out of bounds section, there's a model local rule which covers that, a player, which allows a player to do that. Now, we're not going to do it at elite level, obviously, but you know, for just regular, you know, club golf, you know, most if not all clubs have implemented it. If they haven't, I would encourage them to take a closer look at that rule because it's really good. And I think on a lot, certainly on the tournaments that you know, my daughter plays in, they do exactly what you guys have just been talking about there, just to, again, to keep play moving.
Speed up.
Yeah. And, you know, irrespective of whether it's marked red or yellow or red or white, that they'll play every white as red because they want the kids to, you know, to succeed, and they want to keep play moving. So, and I think all these different committees are all adapting in different ways to try and, you know, to try and make the game slightly easier and palatable for the average golfer.
But Stephen, to your point earlier about protecting the architecture, protecting the boundary setup, you know, if it's a par five and I'm 240 out and I got water in front of the green and no out of bounds, I'm going to hit a 3-1. If I go on the water, I can still make par. I'm 240 out. Maybe there's no water, but there's out of bounds left of the green, like street. It's gonna mess with my mind, right? Yes. And it really, you know, so I think there's a pureness there, and you know.
Well, I think if you took, let's take the 17th St. Andrews, right, which is a fairly iconic golf hole,
mm-hmm.
and
I doubled
and
it.
You make that red. I think Martin Slumbers would be probably, he's listening to this, returning. Maybe I'll suggest that to him the next time I see him. But I think that the whole fundamentals and dynamic of that golf hole would change if we made it red. You know, that because it's a fairly scary tee shot. You've got to left to right, or you've got to cut the corner. And all of a sudden, you know, it becomes such a less punishing tee shot if it's marked red than yellow.
Or 18 at Carnoustie. Right? 18 at Carnoustie, right? That is not a bounce off the green.
No question. That is very much in play. That's a tough hole, whether it be from the tee or from the second shot, you know, and these elements, when you've got boundaries so close, they are, again, they're fundamental parts of the design and makeup of certain golf holes.
I think it's an interesting debate, especially for the level of golf, but I think more even amateur golfers know what the situation is, know the stakes, and that's going to affect how you think. Right. And just you got to go execute. Right.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you're going to man up there and hit a great shot. Other times, you know, you've got to, there's a strategic element to it. You know, I'm not going to take the shot on. I'm going to lay up short, right, and maybe just get up and down.
Yeah. So, Stephen, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about course setup, because I actually didn't know. And part of the research for this interview, I didn't know that rules officials help set up courses for tournaments. And I don't know if that's always been a part of being a rules official, or if that's a part of your new role as a senior tournament director. Maybe you can clear that up for us just personally. But I know you go to a course year plus before an event gets there. And I think most people talk about course setup with the US Open. That's overly talked about there, but it's not really talked about at a regular tour event. So I'm curious, you know, let's go to a year prior, right? If you go to a year prior, let's say Torrey Pines, because I used to live in San Diego, I'd play there all the time. You go to Torrey and you're there a year before. Walk us through that week. What are you looking at? Are you deciding things like a US Open would, where it's rough length, or are you looking at where hazards should be? I mean, how much does that really change year to year? What's different year to year?
Well, let's talk about one of the events that I've worked on fairly recently, and that was Olympia Fields for the BMW Championship, where Rahm pulled that putt across the green.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a new venue, and that's one of the beauties of the BMW Championship. That it moves around, so you get that renewed energy. But one of the challenges is that you are sort of somewhat reinventing the footprint. And unlike the Players' Championship, which is at the same venue every single year, Torrey's a little bit the same. The architectural changes that you're making to those golf courses year on year are obviously going to be significantly less than when you move around to a different venue that hasn't probably hosted a tour event in a long time.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that we don't have a whole catalog of items for the Players' Championship that we would like to do going forward, because we do. We've got a great master planning list. And that's not to say Torrey hasn't either, but generally speaking, they're going to be making little changes and tweaks to fairway widths and all that sort of stuff. Certainly with if the likes of the USGA come in over a regular tour event, the chances are they're going to probably just tighten a few landing areas and that sort of, because that's the makeup of what they do. They want it to be the toughest test. But so Olympia Fields is a really good example, because we hadn't played there on tour for an awful long time. The last time we'd really played a pro event there, I believe, was it, I can't remember, US Open, I think. Jim
Furyk, yeah, 2003.
So it'd been an awful long time. And, you know, when we did the facilities agreement with the WGA and the club, probably about 3 or 4 years in advance, because that's really what it takes. Because you can't just make fundamental wholesale changes to fairway widths and adding bunkers and getting the agronomics right as well. You can't just do that overnight. It takes a long time to get that done. And so you're working with these clubs probably maybe 2 years out, 2 years plus out, because it's not, you know, you can't just go in there and to these, you know, historic golf clubs. And the same with Kays Valley that we're playing there this year. I mean, that's a Fazio. You know, you want to go in there and make changes, and we've made a lot of changes at Caves. You don't just go in there and say, hey, you just want to make these changes. You know, although we have an internal design team at the PGA Tour, you're always constantly working with the retained club architect, and Caves, it's Fazio and Fazio's team. And then similar situation at Olympia Fields, where you're working with the retained club architect to formulate a plan that is going to be of interest, because the last thing you want to do is go ahead and make all these changes and then when you've left, you know, blow it up as soon as you've left. And that's the last thing we want. So we work with a club there, leading in a couple of years, narrowing a few fairways here, putting in some bunkers and getting the agronomics right. That's a process. You know, for example, Caves this year, where we're playing in August, we've only just finished, and they've been going at it for a couple of years now, making changes, and they've done an awful lot of work. And this is all the behind the scenes stuff that really nobody ever sees. You know, and there's it's not just me. There's a team. We have we have our own tour agronomy department who work with the on-course superintendent, provide them with, you know, wealth of resources available and how to go about structuring the volunteer programs, the type of agronomics that they're going to need to do to get the greens firm and fast like we want them to do without checking out, and making sure that, you know, we've got the right grass types in certain areas, and, you know, the sand is of the right quality and it has sufficient drainage, and, you know, we're always trying to protect ourselves for the worst case scenarios. You know, and it takes an awful lot of time and effort and expense for the clubs to get this right. Time is obviously not on our side in a lot of these cases. And then as you move closer, you're into tournament week, and that's when we really do take over. I mean, it is a bit of an illusion, isn't it? People say, I thought the superintendent set the holes. Well, no, that's not what it is. I mean, you know, our team, for something like the BMW Championship, we'll assign someone who sets up the front nine and someone who sets up the back nine. And that's their responsibility for choosing the hole locations and the tee settings for that day. We don't do it in advance. We'll have an indication or an idea in terms of where they'll go on that particular green and what tees we'll use and what tees we'll save. But really, until we see the forecast leaning in day to day, probably Monday, Tuesday, we'll start to formulate a bit of a plan of attack in terms of, you know, where we're going to go and which hole location fits which particular day because of the weather. And you know, they'll have a little matrix designed and they're, you know, the worst thing you can do is handcuff yourself into a particular hole location and try and force it in on the wrong day when the wind's not, you know, working in your favor. Now, some holes, you know, at some tournaments, you'll see traditional hole locations. Like, for example, you know, it's Players' Championship, you know full well that on Sunday, you're going to see that flag on 17 over on that little right lower shelf. And the chances are that, you know, other tournaments, whether it be the Masters tournament, they'll have that flag middle left on Sunday. You know, the guys do, generally speaking, they do a really nice job in setting up. Do we set it up as hard as we possibly can? No, we don't. You know, we're very much in the entertainment industry. We'll set it up to be exciting. We'll there's certain hole locations on certain greens which may well play a lot harder, but we'll discount those because we like a location on the front right shelf, which has a backstop behind it, and the guys can fly it in and the ball gets to the shelf and it'll trickle by next to hole. And chances are the guy may have a chance of making it and the crowd will get excited as opposed to stuffing it in the back corner and nobody can get to it. And so, you know, there's the element of that. We sacrifice score a little bit because, you know, our job, in my opinion, is to, we're there to provide a platform for our greatest players to showcase their talents.
Yeah.
And sure. Where we as organizers have come unstuck is that if we handcuff them to such an extent, then we're probably going to have egg on our face. And we can all remember situations, whether it be on tour or with other organizations, when we've walked away and said, yeah, you know what, we didn't probably get that right.
Well, how do you
allow athletes to perform?
What's your baseline, Stephen? Because, like, do you guys have certain levels of, you know, obviously green speed is green speed, and they got to be at a certain speed to be tour level. I get that. But when it comes to, like, fairway width and bunkering and tees and distances, it seems like the US Open has a very specific goal, right? Par or above. Where I'm curious, what do you guys root in 2 years ahead? I wouldn't even know where to start in regards to the changes they need to make to get an event ready. Is it just the balancing of entertainment mixed with challenge, and you just have to use your best judgment of where that is? Or what do you root yourself into when you make those suggestions?
So I'm going to answer that question in a couple of ways. I think that the first thing I'd say is that we are trying to, we recognize that we've got the best players in the world and we do need to challenge them. We're trying to find the best golfer for that particular given week. And, you know, when we come to a facility, architecturally, it's pretty much laid out there for you. So you don't want to start forcing the issue. I've never been a great fan on, we as a company are not really that in favor of turning fives into fours. Because, you know, a Crooked Stick was a good example when we played there 4 or 5 years ago for the BMW Championship. You know, it was par 72. You know, when Pete laid that out, the ninth hole and the 14th hole, I think it was, with a big kidney shaped green, and they were both fives. Now, they are still short fives, but their green complexes are really there as fives rather than as just long fours. And you know, we obviously had the debate as to whether you changed it to a par 70. And I was like, no, we're not going to do that. Pete laid it out as a 72, and we're going to play it as a 72. And I accept that they're going to be hitting, you know, in some cases, mid irons into a par five. But it's a, both greens, you know, one's small and one's got a lot of tilt to it. And we're going to play it out. And I'll sacrifice score. Because I'm going to ask you, so we all watch kid, you know, growing up, we all watch golf. What is, name me a tournament that you can remember watching as a kid that was iconic. Can you remember one? Which particular tournament really stands out, or a shot or whatever stands out for you?
I mean, it's easy to say the Masters. I always found the British. I mean, you can't really beat St. Andrews.
But let's say the Masters. Any particular Masters?
Probably 05.
Who won that? Forgive me.
Tiger when he made the chip on 16.
Chip in.
Yeah.
What was the winning score?
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe. You don't know?
Yeah.
Exactly. You don't remember the 05 Masters for the winning score. You remember the 05 Masters for those iconic memories that of him chipping in at 16.
Yeah.
That's the point that I try. I'm very, very focused on score, and I get it. You know, a lot of these clubs don't want to see their golf course taken up. But we are here to create positive memories. And that tournament was remembered not because Tiger won at, you know, 14, 15, 16 under. He won because he played unbelievable golf and hit one of the, and a shot that will forever be in our history. Score is just a mechanism to determine, you know, one over another at any given point in time, whether you're on the first hole or on the 18th hole. So don't beat yourself up about the fact that, you know, 18 under is going to win your golf tournament. Mother Nature is the biggest dictator on score than anything. We had, what did I think 6 under won at 4 under or 6 under won at Olympia Fields.
I was just going to say this, Stephen. I live in Chicago, and after Olympia, I saw Jim Furyk shoot 8 under in 2003. That's because it was very wet that week. It didn't dry out till Sunday, and the scores were low. But it put us, you know, this, and like you're kind of getting to this, this like unnecessary sting on Olympia Fields as a U.S. Open setup. And one, I think they were, you know, happy to see it play tougher, you know, and I think it's also because Conway and Medina have played a little on the easier side when you think of Chicago courses recently. So just
China, what a great facility that is.
Oh yeah. Amazing.
But we had, I mean, you I'm sure you were there. Awful weather. When they played, the place played soft. Now, if you, I don't care what that golf, what golf course it is, if it's playing soft, then a couple of things happen. Firstly, ball didn't release on fairways. So if you hit it in the fairway, it stays in the fairway. And you can put a flag anywhere with these guys. They can clean the ball and they can fly it. They can stop it. It doesn't matter. Now, on the flip side, we had an incredible run of weather at Olympia. We had fantastic agronomics at Olympia in the fact that we pushed the envelope there into realms that on any other given normal week, the club would not have entertained. Mm. And Mother Nature allowed us to do some things at Olympia, which were terrific. And that was for the first couple of days, let me tell you.
It was
all you wanted to have. It was like, I can't remember, I think, I don't know who was leading, maybe at 1 under, I think. Hideki was there at maybe 1 under. And we actually, to be honest with you, between you and I, we had to back off a little bit.
Yeah, no, I know. I think there was a lot of U.S. Open talk.
You know what? I can remember Leish called me to score. He scored. He'd absolutely got it handed to him. I think he shot like 79 or whatever.
Yeah.
He left scoring, and then he came back and he said, "Hey, you don't need to talk to about setup," which usually is not a good thing. I'm like, okay. And Leish, you know what Leish like? It's just, I mean, you can't get or find a better nicer bloke than Mark. Yeah. Let me tell you, folks, he is just an awesome guy. He's Leishman said, "Can you just tell everybody that was fantastic out there? It's absolutely given it to me out there. I loved every minute of it, and I just wasn't good enough out there today. And I, as a result, I shot 79. No, you don't
it's
hear
very
that.
Refreshing.
But some guys, you know, they'll complain and that it's too hard. Like Tiger, in my experience, I have never heard Tiger ever complain that golf course is too hard. Never. He plays the golf course. He plays the course as it's set up, and I'm sure there's times he's wanted golf courses to be harder, but he's never complained that golf course is too hard.
Totally. One other thing I wanted to ask you, I think it gets talked about a lot when we compare the Korn Ferry Tour to the PGA Tour. Very oftentimes you see such low scores on the Korn Ferry Tour. One of the reasons is so many of the players out there are just as good as the PGA Tour players. But if you had to kind of narrow it down, the reason, is it because of the rough length, would you say, is just it's not as penalizing on Korn Ferry versus PGA Tour?
I've got to be honest, I haven't done a comparison on rough heights. I know what our rough heights are on the PGA Tour week to week, because I mean that's something that we're looking at right now in terms of it's funny how, just going off on a slight tangent, it's amazing how that changes. You know, we look at all of our, whatever it's, 48 tournaments, and we'll do a comparison just to ensure that we're not getting cookie cutters, you know. You know, it's amazing how these things go in ebbs and flows. You know, 10 years ago, guys were saying there was too much rough, and then sort of eased off a little bit. And now you know, the sort of the feeling about the membership is, well, we, hold on a minute, we need to have a little bit more off again. So it's the ebbs and flows of that are interesting. But I don't quite know how their sort of rough heights stack up, because I don't work an awful lot of Korn Ferry Tour. I've got to be honest. I mean, you're absolutely right. The quality now across the board on the Korn Ferry Tour has never been greater than it is right now. And you can, I mean, these guys, when they come over to us, it used to be like a little period where they
took time
feed, yeah. And yeah. Now they're off and running. They come out here and there's like no, I mean, look at Scotty Scheffler.
Right. He's,
I mean, he's like adjusted so quickly.
Top 10 every week, it seems like.
Yeah, he's a great player. Our resources obviously on the PGA Tour are considerably different to the Korn Ferry Tour. I mean, what we're doing at Kays Valley, for example, and the money that we're spending to prepare and get the golf course ready, and you know, we're afforded luxuries that often aren't afforded on the Korn Ferry Tour. And I think that's probably it more than anything. And I think the sacrifices potentially that some of these clubs make on the PGA Tour are slightly greater than the Korn Ferry Tour. And
I'm just curious, you know, just to kind of see the differences for your thoughts.
So, Stephen, we got one last question for you, and then we'll get you out of here a few minutes over. But we know you're waiting for your COVID test, so maybe we'll get a few extra from you. But so, if you could make one new rule or change an existing rule tomorrow, maybe it's a shot clock, maybe it's not, what would it be and why?
Well, we have got a new pace policy, which kicked in January the 1st. And that's a good thing for us. I don't know. I think there's still golf's never been a speed sport. It's never been a race. But there is no question, if you look at the likes of Rory, particularly Brooks, BJ, those guys prove that golf can be played at the very, very highest level, but in a timely manner. And being out there on a regular basis, it is incredibly frustrating to see, you know, golf not being played in a timely manner. Now I get it, trying to win golf tournaments, and they're trying to, you know, the money that they're playing for now is phenomenal, and the pressure has never been greater to succeed. And but it never ceases to amaze me, the likes of Rory and Brooks, that, you know, they have their number and they're ready to go and they hit their shot. And I have so much respect for those guys that do that, as opposed to just the ones that, you know, anybody can hit a shot quickly when it doesn't matter.
Right.
Yeah. But true. The ones that are out there week to week contending and doing it in a timely manner, I have ultimate respect for. And I wish a lot more about the younger generation would look to those players and say, it can be done. It really can be done. We've just got to figure out a mechanism to make that work, whether it be just making decisions. Sometimes we can, in all aspects of our life, we can overcomplicate it, can't we? So that's the sort of the pace of play question. Now, that's not to say that there aren't changes coming down the pipeline, because there are. We're working behind the scenes constantly on making amendments and clarifications to certain things, tying up loopholes which we come across, not on a weekly basis, but you know, we'll tie up loose ends with the governing bodies to ensure that things are taken care of going forward. I think rules of golf are in a really, really good place right now, going forward. So I don't really have too much to complain about. I've got to be honest, things are pretty good right now. I can't wait for us to get fans back. I think you can, again, you see that with our the biggest stars. They feed off the energy of the fans, and I can't wait for the day that, you know, our stadium and stands are full again, and and we get that buzz around the property that we all enjoy. And I'm not even inside the ropes. I'm just a passive observer, just watching. And whether it be for the folks at home or for the folk, you know, for the players inside the ropes, it can't come, you know, soon enough.
Yep.
I think we'd echo the same as fans. Totally so, agree. Stephen, thanks so much for coming on. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff that people are going to love about this. And, you know, if you guys want to follow Stephen, I believe it's Stephen PH Cox 27 on Twitter, and PGA Tour Rules on Twitter is probably another good one for people to follow. Any other places we should send people?
No, they're the two main ones from a rules perspective. Just one little shout out. We lost Jeff Haley. We talked a little bit about agronomy and the, you know, the superintendents that are out there putting on, and we are so lucky in terms of the quality that we experience week to week in terms of the agronomics of our golf courses. We're so lucky. And I talked about the tour agronomy department, and we have one, we'll have one this week at Amex, and Jeff was supposed to be here. He passed away. He lives in Jacksonville. He passed away at the age of 58, very suddenly had a heart attack. So that was a big shock for our world. And, you know, our thoughts and prayers are with him, but he's going to be a big loss for our agronomy department, and we were sad to hear that news. So I don't want to finish on a point, but I just wanted to throw that out there. But guys, look, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Maybe we can do this again soon, and we'll hopefully have some more topics when we get this return to spectators plan going back end of the year, and it'll be fun to reconnect.
Be great to have you back on.
Would love that. Thanks Stephen. Have a good week, and hopefully talk to you soon.
All right, you got it, guys. Thank you.
All right, take care.
Take care.